You are listening to the News Project for the week of January 20th, 2020, brought to you by GNAT TV. This week's podcast brings you these stories. Londonderry to explore water needs. Missoula meets Dorset. The play is on. Vermont's tourism industry would really like to see increased state funding. And a Dorset resident asks, are the East Dorset Route 7 traffic improvements really improving anything? This will be an excerpt from the Dorset Select Board meeting. To hear the entire discussion, go to the Dorset Government page on GNAT.tv.
Beginning Monday, January 27th, the town of Londonderry will hold the first of three meetings on water supply and wastewater disposal across both the villages of Londonderry and South Londonderry. Finding ways of managing both water supply and solutions to wastewater have been issues for several small Vermont towns and villages, and the meetings are an effort by Londonderry's town government to address those concerns locally. The town has hired the Dufresne Group, an engineering consultant firm, to conduct a study and gather information about managing these water resources. Christina Haskins, a vice president with the Dufresne Group, described what the study will look at and what will be happening during the first meeting scheduled for Monday, the 27th.
The study is being done to determine if there is a need for community wastewater improvements. The Planning Commission has identified a couple triggers to push them into doing this study that might be the result of wastewater issues, one of them being contamination in the West River, and another one being they're undertaking a zoning update right now and redoing some of their business mixed use and village residential districts, and looking at needs in the future for supporting development in those districts. And so right now they don't know if there's a need for anything related to wastewater improvements. So the study will gather data on existing conditions, any existing potential issues that there are, and we will use that existing data to determine if there is a need for community wastewater, and if so, what are those needs? And then the study will, in a second phase, all part of the same study, but that's phase one, is really gathering the information and finding out if there's a need. And phase two is developing alternatives to address those needs. Yes, we're gonna have three meetings. So the first is gonna be on January 27th at 6 p.m. in the town office, Twitchell Building. The second meeting, so the first meeting is really just to introduce the project and get some initial feedback from the community on what their concerns might be, if they have any input on whether or not they see a need for community wastewater. The second meeting is going to be in late March, early April, and that will be to summarize what we've found with our review of existing conditions and what we've come up with for potential needs. The third meeting will be in October, and that'll be after all of the alternatives evaluation is done, and we'll basically present the entire study at that point.
The meeting will be held on Monday, January 27th, starting at 6 p.m. at the town office, the Twitchell Building, which is located at 100 Old School Street in South Londonderry. Additional information about the meeting is available at the town's website at www.londonderryvt.org. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. For the 15th year, the Missoula Children's Theater, based in Missoula, Montana, will be partnering with the Dorset Players, a local community theater company, to bring a production to the Dorset Playhouse. Two performances of The Tortoise Versus the Hare will be presented at the Playhouse on Saturday, January 25th. The curtain will rise at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. for the performances. Lily Van Haverbeck, the president of the Dorset Players Board of Directors, takes us behind the scenes to describe how it works.
Each year, the Missoula Company features a different children's play that they go on tour with, both nationally and internationally. Children come to the theater on Monday afternoon. We held auditions yesterday, and we have approximately 50 local children from the surrounding area who are participating in the program, who will go through rehearsal every afternoon this week, and then the program will culminate in two performances on Saturday. We have many children who return year after year, and the Missoula Company accepts children in the program from kindergarten through 12th grade. So we have children ranging from the very littlest all the way up through high school. And even after they leave the program, many of the children come back year to year to see the performance. We have two Missoula actor-directors that run our program for us this week. But the Missoula Children's Theater Company has 44 teams of tour directors that visit more than 1,000 communities across the country, presenting each year's Missoula play.
Earlier in the week, rehearsals were getting underway for the more than 50 local students from all around the North Shire who will be part of the cast. They were being put through their paces by two of the instructors from Missoula, and Madison King, a student from the Manchester Elementary Middle School, was one of them.
When I was in second grade, I think, I got into my first Missoula play, and I was like, it was Aladdin, and I was a cloud, and I was like the lead cloud, and I thought it was so fun. So ever since like kindergarten, I've been doing theater. I do theater in Rutland. I've done one school play, and this is my fifth Missoula play. I'm always really excited when Missoula comes around. I wasn't able to do it one year, and it was really sad because I was so busy and I had to go somewhere. But Missoula has always been like the most fun because there's like 1 week and you always get along with everyone, and Missoula is always like really fun to do with everyone.
The play is about a fictional race between the mammals and the reptiles out in the desert, which is usually a hyper-competitive event. But this one has a twist that yields a different and unexpected outcome.
First foot in front of the other, then the back foot goes in front, and then you put the first foot in front of the other, then you do it all over again. Great!
Maureen Chafee, one of the Dorset Players producers, tells us more about the collaboration and how it works.
A board member who was an employee at that Paramount Theater had used Missoula at their theater, and he suggested that we look into it. And the biggest thing was that we were interested in finding ways to have more kids on our stage. And so this gave the opportunity for 64 kids to perform on our stage, whereas during our typical season, we might have just one other show that kids can be can audition and can perform in. And the way they audition is not in a traditional fashion. The two tour directors from Missoula have them play some games. They have them do a little bit of a song. They break them into groups. They have them use their imagination. They have them do some of the movements. They might recite a few of the lines that they will be using as a character. And then they move them around the stage constantly and group and regroup them. And then they miraculously decide who's the perfect person for each of the parts, and we have had as many as 125 kids audition, so sometimes we have to turn people away, but this year it was kind of great that we had a small group appear because everybody was able to be cast, and they'll all have a named part.
Again, showtimes are Saturday, January 25th at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. For tickets or more information, visit the Dorset Players website at dorsetplayers.org or call the box office at 867-5570. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. On Wednesday, January 15th, scores of business owners and people involved in Vermont's tourism industry converged on the State House in Montpelier to press legislators to increase the state's funding support for marketing and promoting the state to outside visitors. While Vermont's tourism budget has been flatlined at roughly $3 million for the past few years, other neighboring states in New England have found ways to bolster theirs, leaving Vermont now fifth out of the six New England states when it comes to investing in this sector. The tourism industry representatives are hoping to see the legislature find a way to boost that current total by $500,000. Meanwhile, the state has also seen a leveling off of the number of tourists and the amount of money they are spending on rooms, meals, recreation, shopping, and services. That's still a considerable amount, nearly $3 billion, and the industry directly employs more than 30,000 Vermonters. But there could be more. Industry advocates, led by the State Chamber of Commerce and a newly formed legislative caucus, are saying. The caucus includes several local representatives, Kathleen James of Manchester, Kelly Payala of Londonderry, and Laura Sibilia of Dover. Representative Heidi Sherman of Stowe organized the day for tourism business owners to come and argue their case to the legislature last year, and followed up this year with a second day under the dome, which saw a much larger turnout of people involved in the tourism business. A morning of testimony from several individuals involved in the tourism industry before the House Commerce Committee got the day started. One of those testifying was Brian Margiotto, the president of the Bennington Area Chamber of Commerce and a co-owner of the Inn at Manchester.
The request we put forth before you today comes in the form of a $500,000 increase to the Vermont Department of Tourism and Marketing promotional budget. But I believe it's more than that. I mean, we can apply lots of buzzwords and key demographic opportunities to it, but this is rural economic development at its best. It is working for the people that are here, and it's helping us to grow our state and grow the opportunities before us. To me, there is no question that a 16% increase in spending is money well spent. There are going to be many people who believe this still falls short of where the state needs to be. But when we talk about assisting one of the cornerstones of our economy, there can be no question that we have to try and try and try harder.
Some of the legislators had some probing questions for some of the presenters.
What happens when we face a warmer climate where we have fewer trees? Or a less vibrant foliage? What happens when we have more storms like Irene that knock out 99% of our covered bridges? And so we have major infrastructure problems. We have a changing culture and climate in this state. And I think that is a big contributor of maybe why people aren't coming in. And I'm not entirely sure if increasing marketing is going to fix it if we don't have farms to bring people here. So I'm curious, as everybody's probably aware, and probably folks would argue that increased taxes in this state make it difficult for people not to want to live here, which is going to contribute to increasing our tax revenue so that we can contribute towards our tourism fund. What are we willing to take money away from to support more tourism economy in this state? Because we're not asking for new revenue streams. We're not asking for a new tax structure. Where does this fit in with supporting the culture and the identity of our state and really fostering economic development?
Well, that's a loaded question. I mean, do you want to dip it in the whole education spending?
Absolutely.
Amy Speer is the State Chamber of Commerce's Vice President of Tourism.
Yes, when you're looking at the market share for visitor spending for the state of Vermont over the last 5 years, we've actually lost some of our market share compared to other New England states. So we feel that it's very important for the money to be spent attracting visitors from out of state. The Vermont Department of Tourism and Marketing does an excellent job with the limited funds that they currently have available. The fact that our meals and rooms revenue grows by about 5% every year means that they're being highly effective with the marketing that they do. And they have a very healthy mix of earned, owned, and paid media that comes out of the department, and I would expect that they would be able to amplify their messaging that they have. Part of the department's role is to amplify the story of Vermont's most iconic experiences, and with really limited funds, we're getting muted by other states like New Hampshire. So with additional funds, our voice can be louder at a larger level.
One of the questions hovering overhead was where the money would come from, with the state budget already tight and many other claims being made by other groups for more financial support. We asked Representative Kathleen James, a member of the Tourism Caucus, what she thought of the ask.
There's no such thing as an easy ask. There are a lot of competing demands, and I think everybody knows that. But we are making a very strong case here today, and we'll continue to make the case throughout the session, that when you invest in tourism marketing for the state of Vermont, we all benefit. When you bring folks here to the state who might not otherwise have come, or you encourage them to return, it benefits our businesses, not just businesses, you know, in the tourism industry. Obviously, it benefits inns and restaurants and shops. But then if you support an inn, they in turn hire plumbers and tradespeople to keep up their facility.
Representative Sherman, who was instrumental in organizing the day, gave us her takeaway.
So right now, we've really started this effort prior to the session so that people are talking about it right at the beginning of the session. Right now, we're awaiting the governor's budget next year. We've been advocating to him to increase this investment in tourism by $500,000. So we'll see if that happens. We're hopeful. But regardless, we still need the legislative bodies to support it. So we're going to work with this committee, policy committee, to encourage appropriations committees, and all of us, as we have a tourism caucus now, so all of us will be advocating for this kind of investment as well. And we're hopeful this year. So we'll see.
There were several North Shore representatives attending the day's events. One of them was Bob Stannard, who put the issue into some historical perspective, recalling similar efforts from his days as a state legislator back in the 1980s.
And the more things change, the more they stay the same. We were having this same conversation when I was on the Appropriations Committee back in the 80s. The state has always struggled with funding tourism. I'm not sure why, because there is a payback. I think from a legislative standpoint, the issue for them is quantitative. How do we know how much we're getting back for the investment that we're making? And of course, it's up to the advocates to show how that happens. I did talk with a legislator this morning who said it shouldn't be so much about tourism as it should be about rural economic development. And that really hit me. It's like, duh, that's exactly what this is. It's not just money for, you know, the rich outlets in my town or the ski areas. That's not what this is about. It's about investing in Vermont in a program that actually works, that generates a lot of money, and that in turn can be used for rural economic development in the state of Vermont.
A press conference concluded the day's events.
When it comes to visitor spending, according to the U.S. Travel Association, Vermont is second to last in growth in visitor spending, and we've lost market share in the last 5 years compared to other New England states. During the same period, while many other competing states have bolstered their tourism marketing spending, Vermont has decreased its spending by 6% over the last 5 years. The economic vitality of Vermont is dependent on a strong tourism industry, and we can't risk losing any more visitor spending.
Secretary Lindsay Curley of the Agency of Commerce and Community Development, whose agency includes the Department of Tourism, was also hopeful the additional revenue for marketing and promoting the state could be found.
You know, they're asking for an increase in tourism funding, and the really difficult job the legislators have is to figure out, you know, if we're not raising fees or taxes, where does that money come from? So, you know, I know they have a tough job, but I think this is a really important industry, and I think today it was a great showcase of what we have to offer here in our state.
On the way out, we caught up with Berta McGinnis, Anthony McLaurin, and Lana Halbin, all of whom have been active in the local tourism scene in the North Shore.
We gave them something to think about.
Right. I think, as they stated in the end, they make policy. They don't appropriate funds. I think that this particular committee of 11 understand the problems. And if they didn't understand before, I think they understand now.
Impressive voices from throughout the state that made the point that you can't afford not to make this investment in this state now.
Yeah, excellent presentations. I think they're balancing budgets too. That's the big issue. One of the questions were, where do we take this out of? Which is an interesting question.
And loaded.
Whether the industry leaders who showed up in Montpelier were successful at tipping enough legislators to view additional tourism spending as an investment that will more than pay for itself, as opposed to money that either can't be afforded or has to come from somewhere else, is a question that will be answered later in the session when the coming year's budget is scrutinized. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Maybe in a few years when they come back and they're saying that they're going to be paving through there,
yep.
we can say, all right, let's cut it, narrow it down, and then they can they can include that as part of their repaving, because it's too bad, because the cutting of the road is not, it's $5,000 construction cost to do something like that. It's not a big deal. And the benefit, I think, is important.
Worth
it. To have to spend an extra $70,000 on pavement because you wanted to narrow the road down is kind of silly.
Okay.
This is to Megan's point that particularly southbound, there's nothing that tells them that there's anything up there. And if we do get an opportunity at any point to narrow the road, we need to jump on it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, when they express the interest in paving, they're going to be paving. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. This does include the rapid flashing beacons for the crosswalk. So, yeah.
So that will be there.
It'll be there. It'll be like the ones in Manchester where you press the button, it flashes the yellow. So that'll be another visual piece that isn't there right now. That'll be there specific to the crosswalk.
And then, it may be that we do use the sheriff more, just trying to get people. Like in Danby, everybody knows there's the spot. And even whether you see the car or not, you know that spot's coming. You're like, whoop, got to slow down now. So we just need a spot like that.
Yeah.
So that will help. Okay.
Ray, do you want to add anything to this conversation?
I've been attending Route 7 planning meetings since 1989. And what you're suggesting doing in the middle of the countryside is a pretty radical change. Normally, when you have a village with pedestrian sidewalks and residential houses along Route 7, like Middlebury, of course, there are stoplights all along and places for pedestrians to safely cross the street. Here, you're talking about putting a flashing beacon on the middle of Route 7, and people that have driven up from New Jersey or Maryland through Troy and all the way out up here are exhausted and have been driving quickly. And when they see the first 40 mile an hour speed zone as they cross railroad tracks, of course there's no buildings and it's obviously a speed trap, and people pay no attention basically for a good little bit. And so the advantage of the way it is at the moment is you're taking your life in your hands when you cross the road. Not really, but the people that are walking like myself pay attention from both directions, and people crossing from the Wilson house to the store have to pay attention now. And it's none of this business like Harvard Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where students just bumble across the street and everybody who goes through there every day knows the students just got out of a physics exam and are not paying attention to traffic. But that's not true here on Route 7. So I think that this is a very risky proposition from a safety point of view. And as you know, the accident that just happened a couple days ago had nothing to do with speeding. It was pitch black.
So there hasn't been a state police report on that accident yet. So I mean, to say that it had nothing to do with speeding is, I mean, all that's just conjecture.
Okay.
So you're suggesting that we're making it worse?
I think you're taking a risk with this solution of the state using phraseology like a 30-foot entrance will work, which slows traffic, lets traffic build up more behind the truck that's trying to enter. I think that's risky. I think having marks indicating that a pedestrian can safely walk across the road after people have been driving for hours, perhaps, or as many as 25 minutes to come south from Rutland after shopping or work, is a risky proposition for the country. I'm trying to think of where else on Route 7 from top to bottom is a country, rural, pedestrian crosswalk.
So you're suggesting that whereas now people pay attention, like yourself or the people at the Wilson House, they may become more complacent because there's that beacon and because there's the crosswalk marked.
Even the elderly ladies who used to cross Route 7 by walking, of course, always paid attention greatly and did not dawdle. I mean, as you recall, the first pedestrian, the pedestrian killing here was a child that was dawdling and not hustling like the five other or four other children who dashed across the road, did not dawdle. One dawdled, so paid the price.
Yeah. Dawdling, you know. It's
I have to disagree with you a little bit in that I feel that what we're doing is adding friction to, you know, reduce speed and increase attention of the driver. That's mm-hmm. really what our focus is. So that, you know, you've got the first of all the speed limit sign, then second of all the flashing speed limit sign says you're going too fast. Thirdly, hopefully the flashing beacon that will at least wake this person up who's coming from New Jersey and make them pay closer attention. Hopefully, just the fact of, you know, it is a major highway, that you and the folks at the Wilson House will not become complacent.
Thanks for listening local. For more local content, visit GNAT.tv.